The date is April 29th, 1983, and we're watching The Hunger. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies where we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the John Blaylock to my Miriam Blaylock.
Wow. I hope I don't end up in your attic someday.
That's right.
I'm Colin Stewart.
And this week, well, as you can hear, we have another spooky movie, and you can hear someone already chuckling in the background. We had him last on our show for The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, and the subject of this movie came up, and so we brought him back for a Halloween episode to talk about this movie. Please welcome back David Owen. David!
Hello! Hello, thanks for having me back.
Oh, well, I'm very excited. I mean, because this is something that Colin often gets to say on the show, but I finally get to say it, or, you know, there have been a few other cases, but this is one of those movies not only had I never seen, I had never even heard of. So I, you know, and I found it interesting because apparently Catherine Deneuve, I read in one of the trivias that somewhere that she is best known by English people for this role. And it's like, I had never even heard of this movie. I knew her name for some reason. I can't name a Catherine Deneuve movie until now. But, you know, I find that, you know, something of note, though, that, okay, I really have no idea what this movie is.
Yeah. Catherine Deneuve had quite a European career. Most of her films were in French, and she actually worked with Godard, who recently passed away. Some artsy thrillers with him, black and white, like going back quite a ways.
Yeah. Right on. Well, this week we are looking back at April 1983, when the movies and theaters were The Deadly Spawn, Losing It, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Flashdance, and, of course, our movie for today, The Hunger, which earned $10.2 million on a $10 million budget.
Yes.
They just made it.
Well, see, I found a couple discrepancies out there. I found a couple sources that said $5.98 million. And if I had hated this movie, I would have probably said, fine, fuck you, The Hunger. Yeah, $5.98 million. I'll mislead my audience just to make you look bad. But no, you know, I'll slip them that 10.2 that I found. At least one source said 10.2, so why not?
Yeah. Probably included VHSs.
There you go. Spoiler.
Oh, right. Sorry. Well, even though I don't think that there's a way that this movie could possibly be spoiled, because no matter how much the three of us talk about it over the next hour, I don't think a person will fully be able to grasp what this movie is until they actually watch it.
Yeah.
However, for those who are spoiler sensitive, there will be spoilers ahead. So if you fear that you will have this movie spoiled for you, then please hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, well, I have found only one this week. Nothing human loves forever.
Mm-hmm.
Do human things love forever?
I guess so, yeah.
Hmm.
And on the back of the DVD, stylish, explicit, it'll take your breath away, but it doesn't say who it's from.
Okay. Well, you know, you have to have some sort of sting from a critic or something. I mean, that's important. You know, I'm wondering, like, if you were to play with a comma in that tagline, like, you could change the meaning a few times. Like, you know, nothing human loves forever, you know, or nothing human loves forever. There, nothing human loves forever. I don't know. Yes. So there you go. I just found four different taglines for this movie, but not very good ones. They do not describe this movie at all. So let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis.
Okay. Music, sex, blood, monkeys. That is the first 10 minutes of this movie. And then, vampire lovers John and Miriam Blaylock are living it up and doing what vampires do best, murdering people and being sexy. But John has a problem, as he's suddenly begun to age rapidly and is looking more and more like his 200-year-old self as the hours go by. It turns out that Miriam's promise of eternal life did not include eternal youth. This is why it's important to check the fine print and read those user agreements. But I digress. In an effort to turn back the clock on his face, John looks to science for help and seeks out Dr. Sarah Roberts, a local researcher who's working on a cure for aging. When Sarah blows him off thinking he's a crazy person, John goes home, becomes full geriatric, and kills a young girl. His fate sealed, John asks Miriam to kill him, but instead she puts him in a coffin and stores him in the attic with all her ex-lovers. When Sarah comes to the Blaylock home, she finds John is gone, but she and Miriam hit it off, and before you know it, they're doing the devil's dance and drinking each other's blood. Sarah wakes up the next day feeling a little bit off. Her boyfriend Tom seems super suspicious, and there's a blood royal rumble happening in her veins. She goes to Miriam, who explains the situation, how they'll be together forever. Sarah runs away, but eventually goes back, where she starts to experience the titled hunger. And unfortunately for Tom, he comes looking for her at the wrong time and ends up becoming Sarah's first feast. After draining Tom of his blood, Sarah stabs herself in the neck while making out with Miriam. Miriam takes Sarah's body up to the attic where she's attacked by her zombie lovers. In her attempt to get away, Miriam falls down a stairwell, hits the floor, and begins to decay. In a twist ending, we discover Sarah is still alive, living in London with her lovers, while Miriam spends her living death inside a box in Sarah's storage room. And there you go. The Hunger.
Hey, summed it up pretty well.
Yeah,
you're also insinuating some very nefarious business dealings from companies like Apple there, you know, like checking your terms and agreements. That's automatically where I go, is all the things on my various computing devices that I've had
every app you signed
never
up for,
read.
Just like, agree. Yeah.
What? This one I actually have to check a box to? Oh my god, you're doubling my time on this one. Yeah.
We should all live in fear of the day that, like, all of a sudden our bank accounts are drained and they're like, well, you said that if we were ever in trouble, you could take all our money. It's right here.
You click the box.
You click the green. Yeah. So, as mentioned at the top, this is a movie I have zero history with. Never heard of it. Never knew it existed. I barely even knew that David Bowie did this much acting. I knew about Labyrinth. I knew about Ziggy Stardust. That was kind of like my knowledge of David Bowie filmography right there. That sort of sums it up in two. So this movie I had just never even heard of. And to find out that this is one of four movies that had David Bowie in it that came out in 1983 alone, I'm like, well, shit, I know nothing. I know nothing. Colin, I mean, that's my history right there summed up. I imagine yours is not much longer.
Yeah, no, it's pretty much the same.
Yeah.
I've always thought Labyrinth was the only movie David Bowie did.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know, I guess I knew he was in The Prestige as well. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah, oh, that one. Yeah, see, I have heard of that one as well. Yeah. I've seen it, but have heard of
but
it.
Yeah, I'd never heard of this movie until it was mentioned. I feel like David's going to become like our deep
deep cuts.
Yeah.
Like the type of movie is like I feel like you can only find on traded VHS.
Yeah. Well, I know we have talked about trying to get Labyrinth in here at some point on the show, but there are some other ones to find apparently when it comes to David Bowie. So, yeah. David, as the person that brought us this movie, introduced it into our lives, spewed it upon our faces like so much spilt blood, what is your history with The Hunger?
All right. Well, so years ago, I worked for the Alternative Video Spot, okay. And I worked in the cult section.
Oh, who could have guessed?
And this was one of the most popular movies in there. So that would have been about 80, late 80s, early 90s when I was at the Video Spot. So this movie came out in 83. I was only 13 at that point, but I had seen it on VHS, you know, when I was a little bit older and stuff, but not much older. But Catherine Deneuve, I had such a crush on her, and the fact that she's in the scenes with Susan Sarandon just was mind-blowing. Yeah, and then everybody loves David Bowie, the more I watch it, the more I recognize all the several other actors that I've seen in things since, including
Carla's husband.
Yeah, one of William Dafoe's first movies appearances. Did you guys catch the cameo at the phone booth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of blink, did you miss it? But yeah, it's there.
Yep.
Jane Leaves is in this movie, apparently. Daphne from Frasier.
Yeah.
And John Pankow is also one of the other phone booth youths as listed. So,
it's an amazing cast for a movie that not a lot of people have heard about. Yeah. One of the reasons I was really attracted to it is it's kind of a really foundational movie for goths. Because it starts with Bauhaus doing Bela Lugosi's Dead, which is one of the most famous goth anthems out there. So the first image is actually Peter Murphy singing Bela Lugosi's Dead behind a cage. And I've read David Jay, the bass player, his bio, and they were talking about the day that they were down doing the shoot, and they briefly met David Bowie and the whole. Anyway, it was a real cultural thing, but the director bringing in Bauhaus to actually perform that song set the tone for the rest of it, and so it's sort of a classic goth horror film now.
Yeah.
And another kind of interesting tie-on to that is the great Canadian band Skinny Puppy. I don't know if you guys are industrial fans from the 80s. But several images from this movie became album covers for Skinny Puppy. Okay. So the whole goth industrial scene, like imagery from the film, some of the sound design have been sampled by bands since. There's a lot of interesting sound effects in this movie and processing stuff. Yeah, yeah. And now I watched it again yesterday, and listening to the, then would have been really interesting effects with the delays and the reverbs and stuff, but it was pretty, analog, the way that God intended. Yeah. Well, so it was an important movie for me as a young high school, early 20s, goth coming out and blah, 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 blah. It was like a pinnacle, right?
Yeah, clearly I was not part of the goth scene. No idea it existed. No idea.
An anecdote for me with this movie, having never heard of it or seen it before, was I was shocked to find that it was available through the Edmonton Public Library.
Because,
they don't even have, some of the more popular, more actually well-known movies that I've tried to get from there. But they had it. And not only that, I had put it on hold probably early August, and I didn't get it till about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And even now there's eight people waiting for it, so I mean it has some kind of following, I guess.
Wow.
Or maybe it's on people's Halloween radar, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a popular Halloween film. Yep.
If you live in Edmonton and you're one of these people waiting for The Hunger, then maybe check out
this episode.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into The Hunger, directed by, and this was my first shock, Tony Scott. This is his first theatrical release. Top Gun was his very next movie. What? How have I never heard of this movie? And apparently his older brother Ridley passed on it because David Bowie was attached, and he's like, nah, I'm good.
I don't think I could think of two more,
opposing film styles?
Opposing films, between Top Gun and The Hunger.
Yeah. See, and I was thinking between Ridley Scott and Tony Scott. That's what I was thinking.
I mean, that too, but...
Yeah. It's produced by Richard A. Shepard, and it's written by James Costigan, as Ivan Davis for some reason. He goes by the name Ivan Davis in this movie. I don't know what the story is there. I didn't look into it. Michael Thomas, Whitley Strieber is the based on novel. Have you read any of the books that go along with this, David?
No, I haven't. Actually, every time I watch the movie, I'm thinking like, oh, that, I should really do that because the books are always better. And I love the movie. Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of on my to-do list that I keep putting off. But yeah, I would love to.
So we open this movie on, like Colin said in his 60-second synopsis, 10 minutes of making you go, what the fuck is going on? I have to say, I was so relieved at the point where I'm like, oh, okay, now they're starting to tell a story. Because I was worried that this was going to be this music, video, acid trip all the way through. and thankfully, that calmed down. The pace calmed down. I wouldn't have been able to handle that much.
Yeah. I watched it again yesterday. I realized there's a bit of a parallel now with Mortal Instruments, City of Bones. The start of that film is very similar to the start of this one, where you're in a club and there's a lot of like scenes jumping back and forth, and you follow the protagonist in the new movie, and she's innocent to what's going on, so you're learning it with her. Where with this one, you are witnessing Bowie and Catherine Deneuve as the experienced hunters.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a different perception, but the way it's structured is really similar, and I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
I found it like it very weird off the hop. I didn't get to the beginning knowing whether they were vampire. Well, I just kind of assumed they're vampires because of David Bowie and he just
looks like one. But
it's a weird choice to me for them to like use those onk knife things. Like they just like, you're so used to the vampires like biting fangs. Like the fangs and everything like that. So, but with them having that kind of as their tool, I don't know. It threw me off. Mm-hmm. And then I was so confused. It's just a very, like, for 1983, it's a very non-traditional, I feel like, vampire.
Yeah.
Like nowadays there's all sorts of like weird shit going on with sparkles, and you know, they can be in the light or they can't be in the light. They can show up in photos or they can't, whatever.
Yeah.
But I feel like I always thought like back in the day things were just a little bit more concrete, but I guess not.
Yeah.
Well, the George Romero's first film, Martin, was a vampire film, and Martin could go out in the sun, and he would actually call into a radio talk show and talk about all the myths that don't make sense. And Martin didn't have fangs. He actually drugged his victims and then took their blood that way, like making an incision.
Mm-hmm. Huh. I thought it was interesting. Well, like the thing that hooked me, like I think we covered this last Halloween, but like vampires are my thing. Like, I love vampires.
Oh, we've covered this two Halloweens in a row because Lost Boys was the year before that.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's always like, well, what's going to be different about this one? And the thing that like really actually captured my attention was the idea that eternal life is not eternal youth, because that is so much a part of like what it is. That's the only reason why anyone would ever become a vampire.
Right? Yeah, like, exactly. So I will say that I was kind of proud of myself, though, that I eventually figured out what everything in this opening was once the story started. I'm like, right on, okay. I'm not losing it as much as I thought that, you know. Like, for a second there, it's just like, did I hallucinate the opening, was my thought, all the monkeys and the sex. And now, from a filmmaking perspective, though, in all seriousness, I am very impressed with some of the transitions that he did, like the way that he blocked the movie so that when one person was like putting their hand through their hair, it would cut to someone else doing the same motion. And I really liked how everything was tied together to show these connections. But what I want to know is, do they legitimately have connections? Like, this jumps way further into the movie, but at the point where Susan Sarandon almost gets hit by a truck and Catherine Deneuve is hugging her note to her chest, does she save her? Like, do they actually have some sort of psychic bond?
I think yes. There's a sound effect that only happened with Catherine Deneuve when she was doing her shining, for lack of a better term. And it happens 3 or 4 times in the movie, and that's one of the first times.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think yes. But do I have proof? No.
Yeah. I mean, I think yes as well, just based on how she, like, talks about her bond, basically, with her, like, sires or whatever, like, even with John and stuff, like,
it
seems like there is some sort of connection there.
Yeah, that was one of the missing pieces of the puzzle for me, though. That's the only thing is, okay, you guys have helped slot that into place. I just got the tall bar in Tetris, and I got a full Tetris, you know?
Well, I mean, I was wondering, because I was reading, like, a synopsis of the book, like, and by synopsis, I just mean, like, the one paragraph description.
Yeah.
And even that paragraph kind of gave more information on, like, the backstory that I don't feel like is covered all that well in the movie. And so part of me was wondering if somebody who's actually read the book would... It seems like there's a lot to fill in, even for, like, how Miriam and John met and came to be, like, what her situation is, like, who, like, what makes one person who becomes a vampire be able to live for, like, at what point does the decaying start? Like, why was Miriam seemingly alive for, like, 500 years without growing old, and then John 200, and then...
Well, I read that the ages that they're actually supposed to be are 6,000 for Miriam, and 300 for John. And that's based on the amount of coffins she has in her attic. It's like, okay, if you assume that every lover lives approximately 300 years, then yes, she would be at least 6,000 years old.
Yeah. And she does mention one of the pieces of art is over 2,000 years old, and one of the flashbacks is Miriam in ancient Egypt.
Ancient Egypt.
So she's at least in Egyptian times, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I would have just liked that to be filled in a little bit, but...
No, and that's true. But that would cut into the precious time of just staring around moodily in shadows.
Yes.
So, you know, don't want to take that away.
that brings up a point that I always scratch my head with. So John, he's told you're going to live forever, et cetera, et cetera. And he's traveled with Miriam several places, right? Mm-hmm. Now, did he never think to ask, why are we carrying all these boxes? Why do we have all these boxes in the attic?
Yeah.
What's in there? Shoes.
Yeah.
I didn't understand, like, whether he knew this was going to happen or not, because it seems like at one point he's, like, trying to get her to tell him when it happened to the others. So it did seem like he was aware.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, but then when he's like 100 years old looking and he's like trying to get her to make out with him and remember who he was and all this, I'm like, well,
yeah,
I don't know. You kind of, it seemed like you should have known this was about to happen.
Yeah. He missed a few cues there, John did. And I thought it was interesting too, when he was getting older, alone in the house watching cartoons, kind of like giggling to himself too. I'm like, you know, John's an interesting guy.
Yeah.
He can play brilliant music and then he's watching Roadrunner.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I like. See, I brought it up, I think, in our Tommy Boy episode, how I recently binged up to date in the series What We Do in the Shadows. And it's so funny seeing something like this where all the moodiness is taken so seriously and just thinking just a tiny little twist to it can get you like this wacky Taika Waititi comedy, you know. I was just strangely, I was seeing the parallels. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
So while we're talking moody and shadows and stuff, the design, the decor of their house, it's like the canopy bed with all of the sheets and like it's just so sensual and beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, this is a horny movie. That is for sure. Like 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even down to the monkeys tearing each other apart in a crazy, lustful way. I don't know. I mean, no, did I take that one step too far?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know if they were like ripping each other apart. I don't know if that's lust.
So Susan Sarandon's character at one point mentions a disease called progeria, and I read that it is an actual disease. I decided to do some light Googling. So it's progeria, also known as Hutchinson-Gilford syndrome, is an extremely rare progressive genetic disorder that causes children to age rapidly. Starting in their first 2 years of life, children with progeria generally appear normal at birth. So she says that it starts at age 5, and there is a discrepancy with the information that I found at the Mayo Clinic, because the Mayo Clinic says first 2 years of life.
Right. Yeah. But then you probably saw recent research where she was going by 1983.
That's true. That is an extra 40 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Okay.
Well, there you go. But progeria, real.
I had heard of that disease, actually. There was a special on that had several kids who looked like they were in their 70s. And it's a crazy disease. Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah. I want to say that, you know, big shout out, especially to 1983, for the makeup of that scene where he's when he goes to see Susan Sarandon's character at the hospital or at the lab, whatever it is. At that point, I'm still not quite sure what's going on. It's like, is he imagining that he's aging? Like, I still can't even quite tell that he's aging. But yeah. The way that he ages while he's sitting in the waiting room. And I mean, first of all, I'm like, we've all been there, brother. Like, I know how that feels. I recently had to wait in a doctor's office for 4 hours so I could get my medical to get my driver's license renewed. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was very impressive, like the subtlety of aging him throughout this scene. I thought it was beautiful to watch. I was impressed. Yeah.
I had actually read in Fangoria magazine when I, like, a few years later, but they still referred back to The Hunger as setting the bar for realistic aging makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It deserves that kind of recognition, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got to say, when it came to the aging thing, I wasn't expecting it to go that way. I thought that what threw me off is, like, they juxtapose his aging and they go back to the monkeys and they show that monkey that's like rapidly aging to the point where it's like face decomposes and all that. And I thought John was going to end up one of those like, you know, on What We Do in the Shadows, like the Baron, whatever, like the desiccated guy who like,
yeah.
What's that? Is it like Nosferatu or like,
yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Like just the skinny, like, corpse looking vampire. I thought he was going to become one of those.
Well, it also gave me strong Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade vibes. You know, you have chosen wisely. Yeah. And I read that to make his voice hoarse when he was an older man, David Bowie went out to like the George Washington Bridge at night and would scream punk songs into the night until his voice was hoarse. And it's like, that's a dangerous thing to do if your livelihood is as a singer. I are you hoping that this acting thing is going to work out at this point? Because that's taking an awful risk, buddy.
Well, he had been trying really hard with the acting thing that around that time.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But when he goes to see the doctor, this is when I really started wondering, what are the rules of vampires in this movie? Because he was looking at himself in the mirror. He's out in the day. You know, and sure, it's raining at first, but when he comes out of the doctor's office, it's bright blue skies. And so I'm just like, okay, well, I guess these vampires, sunscreen's enough for these guys.
Yeah, broad-rimmed hat, glasses.
They don't have teeth. Yeah, trench coat, that's all you need.
Yeah.
I was wondering whether David Bowie actually knew how to play the cello when we have all these music scenes, and I guess he actually learned how. for this movie.
Yeah. He played a lot of instruments. He was really good on guitar. So once you learn one string instrument, it's not too hard to work it out.
Yeah. I wish I had that kind of talent.
I doubt Catherine Deneuve is playing the piano herself, though.
No, they never show fingers with her.
No.
I definitely noticed that. Just her rocking back and forth.
Yeah. That the song that they play as the duet, that's a Schubert song. I have the sheet music for it. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk Alice. So, okay, so Alice was supposed to be... Like, was she being groomed to be John's replacement? Is that what the situation was?
That's a good question. John becomes suspicious of that in that one scene.
Well, that's why he murders her, right?
Well, also, I think he's desperate to feed, hoping that it's going to help him.
Okay.
Yeah.
He attacked that guy under the bridge, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that guy, he never actually feeds. Like that's why I'm wondering why he makes it so personal with the little girl. That's why I'm wondering, is there some sort of rivalry going on there that I didn't catch?
That's a good question. It's possible there is. I kind of assume that the guy under the bridge, he lost his advantage and he bailed because he wasn't going to win.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
At that point.
Yeah. So overcoming the little girl was within his grasp. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought, too. But again, it was like, I don't know, the dialogue was a little bit... The actual story of what was happening in those first... Like, I found once Sarah comes into the fold and meets Miriam, everything is clear. But everything that happens, like, before was a little, like, mysterious. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, the first half of the movie is definitely a slow burn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then by that point, it's like, oh, well, now we don't have David Bowie anymore. Now it's a story between the women.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I mean, 1983, holy shit, good on you. I was so surprised to think that they went there because with those two characters on screen, I'm like, I'm seeing something. Like, there's some sort of sexual tension going on, but I gotta be imagining that. This is 40 years old. But yeah. I was impressed that they went there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's still standing.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, this movie is very, like, to me, it seems like very European in its sensibilities, which is maybe why it's like a cult film and wasn't. I feel like not a lot of people in North America probably were big into it. Like, I kind of wonder if this movie was huge in the UK and Europe or not, or if it had more of a, I don't know, I guess a following there.
Well, one thing that I did find interesting was the Rocky Horror connections in this movie. Right, because, I mean, I already mentioned Dan Hedaya. Now, that's not a Rocky Horror connection, but that's how we can connect this to the Buckaroo Banzai episode that we did.
Yep.
But Clifta Young, who plays Tom, he played Brad Majors in Shock Treatment, which is the sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show. Remember I told you I watched that, Colin? And it was this batshit crazy movie? Yeah. And then Rufus Collins, who plays Charlie Humphreys, was in Rocky Horror and Shock Treatment as well. And then, of course, we've got Susan Sarandon from Rocky Horror. So it's it seems like that's the type of group that has the sensibilities that would say, okay, who cares if we've got a little bit of girl-on-girl action happening? That's cool with us, even in 1983. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if it feels like it's a little male-gazy when it actually does happen. But, you know.
It is. There's a laughable line where she spills the sherry on her. It's like, oh no! And then slow motion, and no, it's like that is very 80s.
Well, I was like, what was it? What was intended to happen when she came to the house? Because she like spills the sherry, and then all of a sudden she's like, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm drying my wet shirt, I'm not just stroking my chest
No. All like just rubbing my chest down. I'm like, you know, wringing it out, trying to squeeze any liquid out, maybe get like.
No, no, she's licking her pinkies and doing circles.
Yeah, basically. She's like, I don't know.
But you know, I do want to say, like I mentioned, I am so proud of 1983 for going there that I think we need to do a little "I used to like this One Piece theater." So, David, you have never done an "I used to like this One Piece theater" with us. No. Basically, all it is a cold reading. So let's initiate you into this. Colin and David, I'm going to let you guys do this one. We're going to do the scene where where Sarah and Miriam are not flirting, because, you know, that would be wrong to do. They're not flirting. They're just having a conversation.
Just talking.
Yeah, so which one of you wants to be Sarah and which one of you wants to be Miriam?
I'll be Miriam.
Okay.
All right.
There we go. at least Colin doesn't have to
get that falsetto.
Yeah. At least now Colin doesn't have to figure out how to say that piece of music. Hopefully, yeah. David's seen the movie enough that he knows how to say that.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Okay. Here we go, boys. Let's get woke for 2022 from a 1983 movie.
All right.
What's that piece you're playing?
It's Lakmi by Bilibis. Lakmi is a Brahmin princess in India. She has a slave named Malika.
Malika?
In a magical garden, they sing how they follow the stream to its source, gliding over the water.
Is it a love song?
I told you, it was sung by two women.
It sounds like a love song.
Then I suppose that's what it is.
Are you making a pass at me, Mrs. Blaylock?
Miriam.
Miriam?
Not that I'm aware of, Sarah.
Yes! I used to like this One Piece theater.
Shirt off.
Wow, you committed to the falsetto. I'm impressed, Colin.
I tried.
Yeah, I figured after the first sentence you were going to be like, no, fuck it. Ah, yeah, right on.
Yeah, that's a good scene.
It is, yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, they're flirting, but they're not flirting. That's why I'm like, am I reading this? And then I was actually just in the middle of putting my notes into my phone about, I'm getting some weird vibes here when she says the line, "Are you making a pass at me?" And I'm like, oh, okay, well, delete, delete, delete. Yes, she is.
Yeah, Catherine Deneuve, she is so classy.
Yeah.
And like, she just communicates so much just with a look. Mm-hmm. So that whole, the innuendo behind every line in this scene with Susan Sarandon. And Susan Sarandon is, for an American actress, she really commands her sexual power. Yeah. And to see that come up to like a classic French powerful sexual woman, the how they mesh together is, I think, one reason why I find it a really powerful, sexually charged scene as well.
So. Well, I was even impressed by the choice for Susan Sarandon to come in, sit down sideways on a chair with arms, and throw one leg up casually over the side of the chair. Who sits in a fucking chair like that? Especially in this place where you basically are meeting this person for the first time.
Yeah.
Okay, just make yourself at home. Like.
Yeah, but the first time Catherine Deneuve's character, Mrs. Blaylock, she meets Susan Sarandon's character in the bookshop. Yeah. There's that telekinesis thing, the sound effect happens, mm-hmm. and she sort of shines.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think from that moment onward, there's a bit of a hold over Susan Sarandon's character.
Okay, so I got the sense that she had kind of casually hypnotized her in that moment, so... Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, but now the thing is that she says I don't know. I think it's a dirty move to make her like do the detective work to track you down at home. Like she says, yeah, I would love to have a conversation or whatever it is she said. I expected her to be waiting in the back corner of the store or something. And it's like, no, bitch took off. Like,
yeah. You know, vampires, they like things done their way.
They're mysterious.
Yep.
Mm.
Yep.
I'm sitting there watching the movie, and my son came up to make something to eat. And he just looks over and he goes, this movie sure likes its hydrophone. Because that's all the background sound is. So I have to give credit to Chris that he's like, it must be a scary movie, right? Because that's the only movie that can get away with using that particular instrument.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was every time they were in the hospital, there was the sound effect that wasn't actually a specific thing in the office. Or it was just, and it was too fast to be a clock, but it was sort of puts you on edge, gives everything a bit of urgency. I thought that was an interesting choice.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot of interesting choices in this movie, that's for sure.
Yeah, the movie, like, I don't know. I had to like watch it in pieces over like 2 days, but it's like, it's unsettling. I feel like I use that word a lot, but like there's no other way I can describe this movie. Just the way things are happening, the score, just the not really knowing any background
You're in these environments that aren't really familiar to you because you've got like this dark lab or you've got this, you know, like, I don't know, ethereal mansion, you know, like,
like we were watching it. My wife watched a bit of it with me more towards the beginning, but she was like, is our TV turned up like as bright as it can be? Like, why is it so dark?
Yeah, this is not a movie to watch in the daytime.
Yeah, you need to like watch it with all the lights out.
Yeah. There is one scene though where they definitely made sure to throw some comfort at you. Is the scene where they're sitting around trying to figure something out and at the lab, and one guy comes in and he's like, "Oh, wow, a Big Mac, thanks."
Yeah,
delicious Big Mac, and he starts throwing around Big Mac boxes, the old styrofoam containers, and I'm like, oh wow, I remember that McDonald's.
Yeah,
but you know, I shoehorned it in there, but I wanted to take a break for sponsorship corner. It's a small one this week. Always on the lookout for product placements in movies this week, The Hunger is brought to you by Mack Trucks, McDonald's, and JVC Electronics, which is, quote, fun machines. Plus the fictional Mardi Gras Club and the book Sleep and Longevity by Sarah Roberts. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. Yeah, the JVC Electronics one was a sandwich board like on top of a taxi. And at like two or three different times in the movie, they managed to take the same taxi with the same ad on it. So obviously they rented the JVC taxi for the day.
Yeah, even I noticed that one. It's like, boom, in your face. It's like, yeah. Whoa.
And that's the thing. I mean, just right from the beginning, where the first 10-15 minutes of this movie, you're just trying to catch up and you just let it wash over you. I have no idea if I was actually missing stuff or not. But at one point I'm like, well, whatever. If I missed the sponsor, then it wasn't in my face enough. But then that JVC one comes up and I'm like, oh yeah, sponsors. I usually look for sponsors. Because I really was mesmerized by this movie, but a lot of it was confusion at first because it's like, where are we? What's going on? Oh, okay. I think I'm up to speed. Yeah. Now, Miriam and Sarah get it on, and then Sarah is she aging as well? Did I was she age? No.
She wasn't aging. She was just like slowly becoming a vampire.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then she was experiencing the hunger because she had needed to have like her first feed.
I was just checking because there was a lot of like, you know, panicking about the blood and everything like that, that I'm like, well, did it treat her differently or something like that? Part of what got me lost was the fact that they did change vampire rules for this movie, where I'm just like, I don't quite understand whether she actually is a vampire, but I was told by David that this was a vampire movie. That's the one thing I knew about this movie going in, was what David told us last time he was on the show. But yeah, I mean, at that point, I'm just like, okay, they're drinking blood, but they don't have teeth. I don't know what's going on. I'm confused. Don't make my vampires sparkle.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen a vampire story before where, like, you didn't have to die to become a vampire.
Yeah, see, because and that,
Most times it's like, you have to like die with their blood in your system or something like that. Or I think in like Buffy, they have to bite you, you have to die, and then you have to come back and drink their blood, the vampire's blood, to become a vampire.
Yeah.
But in this movie, it seems like they just like Miriam just bites her and then puts her blood in her or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Susan Sarandon bit.
Right. Beer her. Yeah.
Yeah, in the love scene, they each feed from each other's inside their elbow.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, but arm. That's the other thing that I don't get is you've got this sensual love scene. Like the neck is far more sensual than the back of the elbow. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know that's one of those zones.
I mean, I guess you risk death.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more practical to use the arm, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then her first feed was to be that male hooker.
Yeah.
Who they did a really good job of making us not like him because he's disrespectful. Spitting his gum out on Miriam's carpet.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It was just kind of lewd and classless. It's like, oh, no, this guy's totally got to die.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's such a scumbag. Like, yeah. Yeah, I literally have that in my notes. I'm looking at it right now. Like, at least you look at this guy and you're like, okay, yeah, he has to die.
Yeah, and his bright white shoes and his black suit.
Yeah.
So when, I blanked his name, Mark?
Tom?
Her husband? Tom.
Yeah.
When Tom comes... We have a bit more sympathy with him because it like she just fed. Is she gonna follow through? Is she not? She has that moment where she pushes him away, but he won't go. So he kind of like does it to himself.
Yeah, I mean, I was cool with him killing him, but after he kills him and she's like, you know, she's embraced the dark side. She's gone Kylo Ren, and now and now. She's like comes out to the living room to meet Miriam. What is the deal with her stabbing herself in the neck? Does now Miriam drinking her blood, does that have anything to do with why Miriam ends up dying?
Yeah, have they switched over who the power holder is? Like, has there been a transference of alpha vampirism?
So I've given this a lot of thought. Do you want to hear my theory? Yeah. No, I haven't read the book. So I really do want to read the book.
Yeah,
I think
might help. Yeah.
Yeah.
We said that with The Shining a couple weeks ago. It's like, you know, maybe we should have read the book because some of this would have been explained. But yeah.
So my theory, and this is new, because I rewatched it again yesterday and I was thinking of that spot particularly. That's just before she stabs herself in the neck as an act of defiance against Miriam's control. That's probably the first time somebody said no to her.
Oh.
They don't choose that life with her.
It's funny. I read that David Bowie said he was actually intimidated by Catherine Deneuve. He wasn't by Sarah Sarandon, but he was by Catherine Deneuve. And I mean, Susan Sarandon and David Bowie, Susan Sarandon admitted to having an affair with him. And I'm like, well, fuck, yes, of course she did, because I would have had an affair with David Bowie.
Yeah, David was pretty inclusive in his taste. So
yeah.
Equal opportunist.
Yeah. Now, okay, so now I'm going to piggyback on what Colin was asking about with the final feeding there. Why do at that point all of the lovers from previous generations now have the energy to stand up as some of them like 1,000-year-old corpses?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what's with this like pseudo zombie scene at the end after, like, why do they come to drag her down to hell now that, you know, Susan Sarandon is the chief vampire?
Did you want to hear the other half of my theory?
Okay. Oh, sorry. Did we cut you off halfway through? Sorry about that. Okay.
Well, if this is the first time that one of the people she's chosen has told her no,
yeah,
and the act of defiance is to open up her own vein, that would mean that Miriam's power is then slipping. And I think Miriam stays young for 6,000 years because she is continually feeding off of all of her lovers from throughout her history.
Okay.
And as soon as her power starts to wane, then the power over them weakens and they then attack her.
Oh, so she was like, her Jedi powers were holding them in their boxes. Is that what's going on?
I think like, so. She could never let them go. She says that several times in the movies that, you know, she can never let them go.
Okay.
I'm going to say, to go back to our, I'm going to say that this is very reminiscent of Elf and Santa's sleigh. So I think what's happened here is, like, you know, all of Miriam's ex-lovers love her so much and they keep her youth afloat. Uh-huh. But in the betrayal of Sarah, she shows them, like, oh, like, you know what? She wasn't all that. Like, and so they all lose their love for her,
yeah,
and they attack her, and it's the end because they no longer believe in her, essentially. Yeah. She no longer exists and must, like, be a decayed corpse. Not die, I guess, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I will say that I appreciate the fact that at least one of the corpses was also another woman. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, this whole bisexuality thing of hers, it's been part of her identity a long time. So it's not just 1983 we have to be proud of. It's, you know, at least 300 years before 1983 as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, but I did wonder, though, whether the stabbing in the neck was the one defiance that they had against how openly they express sexuality in this movie, because she's like, nope, not going to be gay for a lifetime, and tries to off herself. Did I just turn really dark with that? I don't know.
I didn't get that interpretation. I thought more of that Susan Sarandon as a doctor and a researcher and stuff. I think that she doesn't succumb to anybody and didn't feel like she couldn't become somebody's thrall, if you will.
Yeah.
So I think she was balking about the power thing. She didn't want to give up all her power to this other being.
Yeah.
She wanted to take the power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, now that you've said the idea of, I think this is the first person that's ever said no to Miriam, it's like, oh, okay. I like that. Like that just gave me another Tetris in my brain, you know.
I was wondering at the end if maybe Sarah used her research to like just do away with the aging vampire thing.
Oh, maybe.
Oh, well, and she had Miriam's blood to do the research with.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. And the money.
So you're saying that, like, in the movie Blade, she just came up with some sort of blood serum that destroys vampires. Is that what you're...
Or just, like, mutated the vampire gene so that they could have eternal youth.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess, though, it sounds like the idea of this ending was changed by the MGM bigwigs. Like, originally, I guess Susan Sarandon, she liked the idea that it's like a junkie. You're trying to figure out whether you want to stick with the lifestyle or not and everything, like, and she liked that torn. But the idea that she survives in the end, Susan Sarandon was like, no, like, let me kill myself because I've chosen, I don't want this lifestyle. But they wanted to, like, keep it open for sequels that never happened. Mm-hmm. So
that makes sense, because I did think that Sarah, like, killing herself in, a defiant act would have been a better ending than what happened ultimately.
Yeah, but instead you get the Dark Knight Rises ending where Christian Bale sees in Paris, you know?
Yeah.
And I in September 2009, there was a remake announced that, as you can see, 14 years later has still never materialized, but yeah. they wanted to remake this movie. Yeah.
Huh. Well, I'm glad they didn't.
That's right.
I mean, I will say, like, this is a movie to me that would be rife for, like, an HBO series. It gives me, like, I would have to watch True Blood again, but I feel like True Blood ripped off a lot of The Hunger. Just in terms of its, like, sensuality and overall horniness. But I mean, I think that The Hunger could be like a really good TV show. I'm not sure that I'd want to watch it as a movie, but I think as a TV show, if you like gave it some time and really fleshed everything out, it would be interesting.
Yeah.
There's like 5 books to base material off of too, so.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, I'd watch that. That would be great. Yeah. Especially if the design really held up too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there we go. That is The Hunger. Now, Colin, David, on IMDb, it scored 6.6 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 52. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 53% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 66%. Man, that's almost identical. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Like an onk in the neck. Hit us with some reviews.
All right. Chris Alexander from Alexander on Film certified the movie as fresh on Rotten Tomatoes and said, "We know that the hunger of the title isn't just a hunger for blood. It's a hunger to hold on to life, to love, to all those moments that make us what we are, and that brief period of our lives that we shine when we are at our best."
Huh. I like that. That's very positive and uplifting. I like it.
Roger Ebert went another direction and said that The Hunger is an agonizingly bad vampire movie circling around an exquisitely effective sex scene. Sorry, but that's the way it is, and your reporter has to be honest.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he's mean.
To the people, we have Phil Hitchings, who gave the movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, "It's a wonderful tale from the opening sequence with Bauhaus strutting their stuff to Bowie's transformation, then Deneuve admonishing the girl, Alice, Alice, and Susan Sarandon's seduction. I wore out the video and the DVD live in the select few items next to my players." Or no, that's not DVD live. It's "I wore out the video and the DVD lives," that's what it should say, "in the select few items next to my player."
Nice. Yeah, just like Wild Things.
Yeah. Herbert Jones says, 5 out of 5 stars. "I saw this movie back in 1983. Was expecting your typical vampire fare. It is the most atmospheric, unique-looking vampire movie I ever saw because of the direction of Tony Scott. Very haunting and stylish adaptation of the book. This movie really helped change the vampire genre. A+, 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 A+. There you go.
There we go.
Right on. So yeah, 66 is from audiences and 52 and 53 from critics. I have trouble saying where I fall for sure on this movie. There was so much that I loved. I think kind of like The Shining just a few weeks ago. I will admit right off the bat, this is a very pretty movie. They've definitely done some very interesting things. Like that whole first 10 minutes, what a wild trip. It was an exciting thing to watch, but you know, until you know the rest of the story, it doesn't make any sense out of context. But I thought there was some very cool direction going on So A plus to Tony Scott for his first directorial gig. David Bowie, I'm impressed at David Bowie. I thought he was very good. I thought the ladies were very good. I enjoyed the performance. Like, there was so much to love about this movie, but it was a bit of a slow burn. I don't know. I think I'm done with moody vampires is part of my problem. It was low action for a vampire movie, but I did still enjoy it, but I don't think it's going to end up as one of my all-time favorite in the bloodsucker category. Yeah, I have to say that. But I thank you, David, for bringing this movie to us, because, you know, I'm glad I watched it for sure, 100%. Yeah, there's other vampire movies I'll turn to first. But David, on this rewatch, tell us your thoughts on The Hunger.
Still one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
Now, I consider myself an elder goth now. I still love the film. When I was a baby bat and just kind of finding my feet, this stylistically really made an impression on me. So, you know, going to high school in the 80s, that was an impressionable time for me. And this was a pivotal movie.
Yeah.
So I still have a really fond spot in my heart for it. And watching it again last night with my son, who, like, oh, it was really slow and all that. Intriguing story, but yeah, the most of it was like, he's used to TikTok and streaming channels, and so it wasn't quite his cup of tea, but yeah, he couldn't discount the fact that it was pretty intriguing as well. So
yeah,
I think it stands up. It's still important for me. I'm glad that we're doing this podcast and introducing it to some other people who may not have heard of it and yeah, would like to broaden their David Bowie vocabulary.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not just Major Tom.
That's right.
Well, Colin, bring us home. What did you think of The Hunger?
You know what? Like, when we started, I was kind of meh about it. But the more we've talked about it and the more I've reflected on it, the more I appreciate it.
Right?
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard for me to, like, give it a rating. And at the same time, like, I'm not sure that I would necessarily watch it again. But I would recommend it to people to watch, because yeah, I think what I'll say about it is, like, it's exactly what a vampire movie should be, even though to me it's kind of the most un-vampire movie there is. But how it is like, the movie itself perfectly captures the essence of what a vampire is supposed to be. It's like moody, mysterious, sexy. It's just. It has the vampire stink on it.
Yeah, I can see so many influences on more modern vampire fare that probably came from this movie. Even totally. Going to What We Do in the Shadows. You know, that's one of them. Or, you know, like Lost Boys would have taken from this movie. All these different movies that, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think as someone who, like, I would call myself a vampire expert, and I feel like this movie filled in a lot of. It's like it was an education to me. I guess I'll put it that way.
It's source material you never knew existed.
Yeah, and I imagine, as I watch more vampire-related movies, I'm gonna be like, oh, they took that from The Hunger. Like, I think I bet. I can just see that this movie was probably a massive influence on that genre. So, yeah.
Totally. Right on. Well, there we go. That is The Hunger, and that's our show for this week. Oh, boy. A big, huge thank you to our guest, David Owen, for bringing us The Hunger.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
David, anything else you want to shout out here? Because, I mean, If we're going to try to introduce people to a movie like The Hunger, I mean, give us.
Where do people go next?
Yeah, give us another one or two David recommendations, and who knows, maybe by dropping it right here on our recording, we may end up watching another batshit crazy movie at some point down the line.
Well, okay, don't say I didn't warn you, but how about the original Wicker Man with Christopher Lee?
Okay.
Good old Hammer film from the 70s.
I've never actually seen it, but I am aware of Wicker Man. It helps that there's a Nicolas Cage version of
it. It has nothing to do with the Nicolas Cage, but the story... No.
There we go. We've got something set up for next Halloween.
There we go.
If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is, well, just tell people. Word of mouth spreads so much for the shows out here that are trying to build an audience from the ground up. You have no idea what just telling one or two people... Actually, you know what? This week, don't tell anybody about our show. Don't tell anybody to listen to our show, but tell all your friends to tell somebody about our show. That's how we're going to do it this week. Right? Yeah. You know, don't be like, I don't want you to listen to it, but I want you to tell one of your friends to listen to it. That's how we're going to spread our word this week. Or if you want to go above and beyond, just use whatever app you listen to your podcast on and give us some stars. 5 stars helps drive us up the charts, helps us get noticed using the science of the algorithms on those sites. Or if you want to help us out financially and become an executive producer of the show, you can go over to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne, become part of our Patreon family, and get a shout out, just like executive producer Joshua Blum.
And be sure to check out our website, www.IUsedToLikeThisOne.com, where you can find links to all of our podcast episodes and social media pages. And if you want to drop us a line, you can do so at IUsedToLikeThisOne@gmail.com, and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us talking about them on the show.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. If you'd like to hear more from me and my stories of being a bus driver, check out my other podcast, In Front of the Yellow Line, anywhere pods are cast. Ooh, our spooky season is over. Next week, we start listener request episodes. I'm very excited about the month of November. All of the month of November is listener requests. If you put in a request, you are going to be hearing it sometime in the next 4 weeks. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One. Oh shit, did I sent one of you the wrong script.
Uh-oh.
Or did I send... I think I sent David the wrong script.
Okay.
Yes, I sent David the wrong script. Hold on, let me... I was torn between which... Wait, I think it's this one. There it is. Yeah. I was torn between which scene I wanted to do.